From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Bangladeshi forces stormed the Dhaka cafe, where up to 10 armed terrorists had taken dozens of people hostage. There were 20 people killed. 13 others were rescued, and 6 gunmen were killed by police. The so-called Islamic State has taken responsibility for the attack. Army spokesperson Colonel Rashidul Hassan told Reuters Saturday morning that the situation was under control. At around 8 a.m. local time on Saturday, following a 13-hour siege and failed negotiations with the terrorists, more than 100 heavily armed Bangladeshi forces launched the operation to free those who were held inside the upscale cafe in Dhaka's diplomatic district. Reports that Italian, Japanese, and Indian nationals were among the hostages were confirmed by Italy's ambassador to Bangladesh, Mario Palma, who said that 7 Italians were inside the cafe. Cynthia McKinney has been spending time in Bangladesh recently. She interviewed someone she referred to as a knowledgeable, politically active Bangladeshi about the recent attacks.
Given this high level of security with all of the military installations as well as the Prime Minister's house, there are security checkpoints every few hundred yards. So how can 8 or 9 young people with military-grade weapons walk around and then descend into a restaurant? How does that happen?
Yes, ma'am. There are police checkposts every few hundred years or so. So there are armed guards, undercover security forces all over the area. So almost every car gets checked at those posts. So if you have your glasses tainted or colored, you'll definitely be checked at those posts. So it is almost impossible for a group of terrorists or personnels carrying heavy weapons and artillery to enter that area undetected and make an attempt to threaten the lives of civilians, officials, and foreign nationals. So it is a big question now as how these terrorists, whoever they are, made their way into the international quarter of the city so easily and accomplished whatever they set out to do. So it's a big question now. Like, did they have an insider to help them carry out their plan? So we can be sure as of now. And I'd also like to say that Bangladeshi people have embraced each other and lived side by side in peace and harmony, regardless of the differences in religion, culture, social identity, since its inception in 1971. So these recent incidents involving killing of foreign nationals, religious personnel, and bloggers are ruining that harmony and tranquility. So, ma'am, what I fear the most is that these incidents involve Bangladeshi people and turn them against each other. And I've already started seeing signs of rage and dispute between people of different religious and social backgrounds in the social media. So the million-dollar question right now is, who benefits from these attacks? Like, who are truly behind it, and what do they really want from Bangladesh? So I guess we'll have to wait and leave that to time. So that will point out the true culprits behind the curtain, ma'am. That's all I had to say.
For more, we spoke with the former six-term member of Congress, who is also the 2008 Green Party candidate for president, Cynthia McKinney, from Bangladesh, Saturday. Cynthia, thank you for your time. It's a pleasure.
Okay, thank you.
Well, you are in Bangladesh, and you've been there for a good while. You have a pretty good feel for the lay of the land, and you've seen both the events as they were covered there and when, and the coverage on CNN and other Western media about the events there. You want to talk to us about that?
Well, honestly, I didn't pay very much attention to the Western media because I know that there's a line. The interesting thing is that I didn't get called by any of them, but I did get called by RTTV. So I did the interview with RT, in which I tried to set the geopolitical context in which this string of events has taken place. And of course, with our experience, you and I both are old hands at this. And you know, we know a draw play when we see it. We know a screen pass when the offense is lining up.
The quarterback sneak.
We can understand these things, and the quarterback sneak, right? And so we've seen this before, and we know what it is. You and I both were in Libya. We've been to Syria, and then of course you helped me get to Venezuela. So we know what destabilization looks like, and it starts with demonization, and of course. There was a time when very few people knew what Bangladesh was, knew where it was, knew that it even existed. And now, all of a sudden, everybody knows about Bangladesh, right?
Wow.
And it's and the opinion of Bangladesh is negative. And this is being manufactured. This is being created. This is the first step, the demonization.
You know, Bangladesh to most Americans is a song George Harrison wrote like in 1971 or something. And then some images that went across the TV set of starving babies and such and a campaign to provide aid. And I think that was probably the last time that the words were mentioned in American TV.
You're probably absolutely right about that. And so, but Bangladesh, quite to... the contrary of those older images, of course, it's still a poor country, but it's a vibrant economy and it's growing. And you can just feel the pulse of the entrepreneurial spirit of the individuals, of the people here. These are a hardworking people. I mean, you know, I have seen them do backbreaking work, work that doesn't even really exist in the United States because things have been mechanized and automated. But these are hardworking people and they love their country. That's why the U.S. has not been successful in getting these military bases that they want and have wanted for what, almost 40 years now.
Maybe you could give us a little the description of the geopolitical situation, the location of Bangladesh, the strategic importance of it, the relationship to things that are going on in the world right now.
Well, right now, the United States is doing daily patrols, if you can imagine this. If you can imagine the amount of taxpayers' dollars being wasted by doing this, the United States has several warships doing daily patrols in the South China Sea. And so if you leave the South China Sea, now, you know, many people, okay, so where's the South China Sea? Okay, you know, Hong Kong. And so if you're sitting in Hong Kong airport, then guess what's right there? The South China Sea.
Right.
And just from, if you go south, and then west, you want to get to the other side of the landmass, you have to go through the Strait of Malacca. The Strait of Malacca is bounded on one side by Indonesia and on the other side by Malaysia. So, of course, all the strange things that have been going on in Malaysia, because Malaysia hasn't been playing ball with the U.S. And so you go through the Strait of Malacca, and where are you? In the Bay of Bengal. And so that is, Bangladesh has the longest, they call it the sea beach, the longest sea beach in the world. But that is the littoral of the Bangladesh and the Bay of Bengal. To the south, or just as you enter, if we keep going through the Strait of Malacca and then we enter into the Bay of Bengal, you've got Myanmar, which the United States was most recently able to turn to from foe to less foe. And then you've got Bangladesh, and then you've got India. So the United States has been trying to get a military base in Bangladesh since the mid-1980s. And of most recently, the U.S. has been trying to get some kind of status of forces agreement or base lease agreement with India. And India has been playing ball with the U.S., doing maritime drills with the U.S. and Japan on its particular side of the Bay of Bengal. And all of this is directed toward China because Bangladesh is extremely friendly with a military relationship with China and Russia.
It provides a little insight into what Modi's motivations might be for conducting the drills. Maybe he thinks he's relieving some pressure on Bangladesh from the United States.
No, the Indians are extremely self-interested and are motivated by their own national interest, or how they define their national interest. And so the Indians have opened up a new relationship with Israel, and that is a military relationship. So the Indians, basically, there was a time when you could count on the Indians to be sort of steadfast, not necessarily in their opposition to the U.S., but they, in certain areas, they were in opposition to the U.S. For example, the very strong role that India played with the Non-Aligned Movement. But now India has turned a little bit more toward the U.S. and Israel, refusing to vote against the Israelis in the United Nations, which was a first, exchanging visits by the prime minister and the president, which was also a first. And so we've got a lot of firsts going on. At the same time, right next door to India is Pakistan, which also is a part of the nuclear club. And the Pakistanis, who used to be stalwart allies of the U.S., are also changing, such that China recently issued a statement that was startling. Basically, what the Chinese said to the world was that if anyone messes with Islamabad, they're messing with Beijing. Mm. Quite a stunning new set of circumstances going on in this geostrategic game that is being played by the U.S., Russia, China, India, and Pakistan.
You have a bunch of interesting contradictions there, too. For example, historically, India allied itself with Russia and or the USSR because each of them had some contradictions with China. And China now has, as one of the primary motivators, in any event, the SCO is admitting India and Pakistan at the same time, while China attempts to broker business deals, port development, and such, involving both parties.
Yes, that's right. And the Chinese are with their new Silk Road proposal, they actually are seeking to unite the continent, the Asian continent, in a way that is mutually advantageous for everyone who participates. Of course, the United States is stoking fears of Chinese colonialism. Can you imagine the United really? States trying to stoke some fears talking about imperialism and colonialism?
So looking at what's happened in Bangladesh, both the two immediate terrorist attacks and the quote-unquote string of them that have happened recently inside that context, what do you think is at play here?
Well, I think the Bangladeshi government is being pressured on several fronts. And that's basically coming from the U.S.-Israeli axis. Bangladesh does not recognize the state of Israel and does not allow its nationals to travel to Israel. They also do not allow Israeli passports to enter into the country. So that is a huge factor with an economy that's growing at 7%. It's amazing. You can feel the energy when you get here. And so, of course, the United States and the Israelis both don't want to get locked out of that. Then, of course, the overall desire for hegemony that is what the United States does best. As I noticed that the Icelanders have allowed the United States to open a military base or reopen the military base that was formerly closed now in Iceland. So, you know, in my opinion, only the people of the United States can stop this madness of the military, industrial, financial, media complex. And to the extent that we fail to do so, innocent countries like Bangladesh get swept up in the whirlwind.
And that whirlwind is essentially destabilization with terrorist attacks, a loss of confidence in the political structures and other structures inside the country, and setting people off against each other. Bangladesh has been particularly noteworthy historically over a period of millennia as a home to diversity. It's one of the crossroads of the world, and people from China and people from Europe and everyone in between, Africa, came through there, settled there, were welcomed there, integrated into this culture there, or the culture maintaining its diversity nevertheless. Is this an environment where that kind of, Shia-Sunni fighting, for example, that was stoked in Iraq could be stoked?
Well, I'm certainly hoping that that's not the case, and I don't think it will be the case. However, there are mercenaries, and of course, that's what we have to deal with, the mercenaries who are being paid to stoke these rivalries and hatreds.
It's not as easy, though, geographically, to roll a fleet of Toyotas, for example, full of mercenaries into Bangladesh as it is across the deserts of Syria and Iraq, is it?
Well, you'd have to find a road first.
Right. Yeah, there's that, too. But you'd have to cross the Indian subcontinent, and perhaps this is one of the reasons that the U.S. is seeking some sort of military alliance with India.
Well, the United States is playing the oldest game in the world, or trying to play the oldest trick in the world, and that is the divide and conquer game. And so you've got the New Development Bank, which is the development bank that actually speaks about independence and dignity.
And development.
and development out of the BRICS organization. So we now know that what's happening in the B part of that, which is Brazil, and the rest of it is India, China, and Russia, and South Africa. So India, if the United States could break BRICS, then it would be trying to find the weakest link. Well, clearly the weakest links are not Russia and China that just signed some 30-odd cooperation agreements So the weakest link is probably India. And that's why we see the United States doing naval military drills, and India's buying drones from Israel, and, you know, sort of shoring up its own interest, but at the same time, raising some doubt, at least in my mind, about its commitment to BRICS.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, too. If you look at the acronym BRICS, B-R-I-C-S, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, it seems that they first targeted the ends. They picked off Brazil, and they have South Africa in turmoil and pushing very hard there. And now they're hollowing out India in the middle, leaving just R and C with India between them. It's almost geographic imagery.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff is not an accident, the labor turmoil. But you see, under Zuma, I think the corruption is so bad that the U.S. had Zuma all along. They had the S. And we saw that on shocking, shameful display when South Africa voted to bomb. Well, they voted for the no-fly zone over Libya,
right,
which led to the bombing of Libya. So not even the South African ambassador to the UN could believe his instructions. He went hiding, and Susan Rice, Dr. Susan Rice, went to find him and delayed the vote until they found him to put it on, you know, just maliciously putting it on the record. Not that they even needed the vote, but they just put it on the record. So you're right. That takes care of the B and it takes care of the S. The I is the next one. And you know, it looks as if it's the weakest link.
Yeah, Russia and China, meanwhile, at the SCO, you saw the presidents of both countries make affirmative statements that they consider that they are in a geostrategic alliance.
Yes, yes, yes. So, and it makes perfect sense when you've got the United States saber-rattling in the South China Sea, and you've got the turmoil on, literally, on Russia's front doorstep with Ukraine.
Yeah. What do you think are the prospects in the short term for Bangladesh with this, you know, the attention that's being focused on it right now, and this both by ISIS, quote unquote, in any event, by someone motivating terrorist attacks, and the wrangling going on around it, including India's ambivalent situation at best?
Well, I suspect that the international community is going to learn a lot more about Bangladesh in the days ahead, and it's the demonization is not going to stop, and therefore Bangladesh is probably in for some rough seas. I wish that were not the case. As I have said, I don't want to see Bangladesh become Iraq or Libya or Syria. But I have to understand realistically that we've got people in charge of the military machine in the U.S. that don't hesitate to use it, want to use it more, and don't mind killing people in the process of the pursuit of their goals. And those goals are not goals of the average American people, but satisfy that small group that's able to leverage their power for economic gain.
Cynthia McKinney is a former six-term member of Congress, and she was also the Green Party's presidential candidate in 2008. She's recently been spending time in Bangladesh, and we spoke with her from there via Skype Saturday. There were reports in Russian media Friday that Ahmed Shadayev, the Chechen nationalist who authorities say was the mastermind behind the deadly Istanbul airport terrorist attack earlier this week, had received asylum in Austria, which helped him avoid repeated attempts by Russian authorities to extradite him on charges of previous acts of terrorism going back more than a decade. Western authorities say that Shadayev organized the fatal attack on the Istanbul airport that took the lives of 44 people and left more than 230 injured. A Turkish media report citing police sources said Shadayev joined the Islamic State in 2015 and has been fighting in Syria. Shadayev's history as an anti-Russian terrorist dates back at least to the Second Chechen War between 1999 and 2000, when he joined Islamic militants seeking to secede from Russia and lost an arm. Later, authorities said he was a representative of Doka Umarov, the Chechen militarist who declared himself president of independent Chechnya and later proclaimed himself emir of the entire North Caucasus region of Russia, which he in turn proclaimed as the Islamic State of the Caucasus Emirate. As for Shadayev, in 2008, he was detained with other Chechen nationals in Sweden as police found Kalashnikov assault rifles, explosives, and ammunition in his car. He ended up spending more than a year in a Swedish prison and was then released. In 2010, he was arrested in Ukraine with his mobile phone files containing instructions for a demolition technique and photos of people killed in a blast. Russia requested his extradition on terrorism-related charges, but the European Court for Human Rights ordered Ukraine not to hand him over to Russia, with Amnesty International also urging Ukrainian authorities to halt extradition. The group claimed that Shadayev could, quote, face an unfair trial and would be at risk of torture and other ill treatment, closed quote. Andrei Perzhidomsky, the deputy chair of Russia's investigative committee, said Shadayev had a leading role in training recruits that would then commit terrorist acts in both Russia and Western Europe. He added that in Syria, Shadayev commands a unit consisting primarily of immigrants from the North Caucasus. Meanwhile, another terrorist group, being protected from prosecution, struck a UN aid convoy in Syria late Thursday. Fighters from the Al-Qaeda-linked group Jaish al-Islam shelled a UN humanitarian convoy near Damascus. The driver of a vehicle in the caravan was severely wounded. Despite repeated ceasefire violations, the UN Security Council, led by the U.S. and its allies, rejected a bid in May by Russia to add the group to the UN's list of terrorist groups in Syria. This was Elizabeth Trudeau, the State Department's Director of Press Relations, as she was asked at a daily press briefing this past May about the Russian effort to add the group to the UN's list of terrorist groups operating in Syria.
There seems to be a renewed interest from some members of the ISSG, not you, not the United States, and certainly not your allies on the ISSG, to have the UN add at least one of the groups, Arar al-Sham, into the list of groups that are not included in the ceasefire. Yeah. You, in the past, have opposed such a move, and I'm just wondering if there is anything. There seem to be new allegations that they are pretty much interwoven with Nusra, which is not covered by the ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if there's any revisiting of this position.
There's no change in our position. We do know the reports that Russia's proposed placing, we believe, both opposition groups, Jaish al-Islam and Ahrar al-Sham, on the UN sanctions list that includes ISIL, the al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group. Russia is publicly attempting to designate groups that are parties to the cessation of hostilities. Such actions, we continue to believe, would have damaging consequences to the cessation, just as we are trying to de-escalate the situation on the ground.
In a statement issued Friday, the Russian Defense Ministry said that the Jaish al-Islam grouping, which had claimed to belong to the so-called moderate Syrian opposition, carried out shelling of the UN humanitarian convoy in eastern Harasta in Damascus province. Jaish al-Islam, Army of Islam, is a coalition of Islamist militant groups based near the Syrian capital, Damascus. The group is supported by Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar, and is part of a larger coalition called the Islamic Front that seeks to make Syria a country ruled by Sharia law, precisely what its rival Islamic State, or ISIS, aims to achieve. The group positions itself as brother fighters of the al-Nusra Front, the Syrian branch of al-Qaeda that is recognized as a terrorist group by the UN and many nations, including Russia, Iran, and Egypt. Back in May, the director of the State Department's press relations office was also asked about this.
And Jaysh al-Islam. I mean, they have exactly the same bylaw, almost the same bylaws. They don't have a constitution. They have what they call internal document. They espouse the same dogma. They believe in the same thing. Mm-hmm. They practice the same practices as Jabhat al-Nusra mm-hmm. and as al-Qaeda. Why shouldn't they be designated as terrorist organizations?
So, you know, we constantly review information.
Right.
We are constantly assessing these groups. At this stage, our position is that these groups are members of the cessation mm-hmm. of hostilities. We continue to have dialogue with them. If our position changes, you know, we'll make that assessment then. So, but we are in constant review of this.
So you're not bothered by the fact that some of their leaders actually, they go from one place to the other and back and forth and so on.
You know, we've talked about the intermingling on the ground. We've talked about, especially in areas of Aleppo, mm-hmm. where it's very difficult to tease that out. You know, this is one of the commitments that we made when we released the statement with the Russians on Monday, that commitment to try and differentiate. Mm-hmm. So we are aware of this. You know, as we get more information, as we assess, we continue to look at it.
And I promise my last question on this. I mean, you always say that you want to support the secular opposition. I mean, there's, according to their statement, there's nothing secular about these groups. In fact, they want, you know, a very strict Islamic caliphate in Syria.
At this stage, they are parties to the cessation. We'll leave it there.
Jaish al-Islam had previously admitted to using chemical weapons against Kurdish militias in Aleppo earlier this year. It is also known to have used human shields and published ISIS-type execution videos. The group's Thursday attack on the UN humanitarian workers in Syria added an ironic context to a speech delivered earlier in the day by the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, which said that UN member states have an urgent moral duty to act together and prevent the carnage of terrorism. He was speaking to the General Assembly Thursday during the fifth review of the UN Global Counterterrorism Strategy.
Matthew Wells filed this report from the United Nations.
Speaking on the 10th anniversary of the adoption of the global strategy, the Secretary-General described how terrorists had seized the initiative across a vast swathe of territory in recent years. The unforeseen challenges of new conflicts, foreign terrorist fighters fueled by new technologies and heightened media exposure meant that counter-terrorism efforts had fallen short. Mr. Ban said he was concerned about a growing drift towards xenophobia, homophobia and outright racism in many countries that terrorists could exploit in order to gain recruits.
We have an urgent moral duty to do all we can to prevent and end this carnage, taking collective preventive action against terrorism in the spirit of the United Nations Charter is the only way to secure peace and prosperity for succeeding generations. I appeal to you to show the world your resolve by acting in unison and adopting a resolution by consensus.
The President of the General Assembly said that a debate on the global strategy would take place on Friday morning. Matthew Wells, United Nations.
But despite all of this, the U.S. State Department did not appear to back down a bit from its previous stance with respect to any of these groups. For more on that, we spoke with Mark Sloboda from Moscow, international relations expert on geopolitics at Moscow State University. Yeah, so the narrative seems to be unraveling, huh, Mark?
I'm not so sure that the narrative seems to be unraveling. The State Department has, had incoherent back and forth ranting statements punctured by Matt Lee and dozens of others for years now.
That hasn't
changed the narrative coming
that's
out
true.
Of
that
Washington.
Is the narrative, actually.
It hasn't
right?
changed yeah. the narrative coming out of the Western press. So I'm a little more hesitant to see the narrative crumbling. The fact that an occasional beam of light or, absolute inconsistency manages to pierce through that doesn't necessarily mean the narrative is unraveling. I'm a little more pessimistic in that regard.
Yeah, you're right. The narrative itself is almost like beat poetry or something. What's interesting about it, of course, is the fact that the very same
group that the Russians were attempting in May to get added to the list of terrorist organizations is now, blowing up humanitarian aid workers from the United Nations.
Yeah. What's more, there was a story again. This wasn't picked up in the Western press at all, but it is covered in Russian and some of the international press. There was a Russian security guard, a Russian troop that was providing protection for the UN humanitarian aid convoys. And there was a suicide bomb attacker, again from the so-called moderate rebels, that was driving towards the convoy. And this Russian, he refused to move away from his position, even under orders from above, continued firing, managed to detonate it with small arms fire right before it reached his position, killing him, but saving the humanitarian aid convoy from being hit by a suicide blast. There are some heroes in this world still. Yeah. We live in a very cynical, pessimistic age, but there are some heroes still out there, and this Russian soldier just sacrificed his life proving that. Completely uncovered in the Western press, of course, because that would be a real challenge to their narrative.
Yeah, for sure. This comes at the same time that the reports come out about Ahmed Shadiyev, about the fact that, let's see, where do you want to start with him? The fact that he was arrested and held for a year and then released in Sweden, that... Russia has tried to extradite him a million times, and he found safe harbor in Austria, and he's been sheltered from the West, and then he ends up masterminding this attack in Istanbul. It's another case of exactly the same thing.
Yeah, the situation here with Chataev is that he is alleged with good intelligence to be the mastermind who arranged the Istanbul attacks. And the man has been arrested close to a dozen times in Europe. Most often he is found with weapons or explosives on him. And the European Union, individual members have always refused to extradite him to Russia under claims that this jihadist might be abused or tortured, right. Which is a little funny because, the European Union was running CIA black torture sites for years out of there. The U.S. and U.K. torture of jihadists is well known, but it's a question of which jihadists, and if a jihadist has primarily previously targeted Russia, well, then, it's hands off him, I guess. But he was granted political asylum in Austria. Most recently, he came from Georgia, where he actually did a brief prison stint, and then he immediately went to ISIS. But most egregiously, in 2010, he was arrested in Ukraine, again, with guns, explosives. And the European Court of Human Rights blocked his extradition to Russia under claims that it would violate his human rights, torture, so on again.
With Amnesty International chiming in, by the way, as a friend of the court on his behalf.
Yes, indeed. if this isn't a complete condemnation of the European Court of Human Rights and the EU, I don't know what is. If the Kremlin was smart, it would use this Chataev incident, it would sing it from the heavens, and use it as opportunity and justification to pull out of the European Court of Human Rights, something which Britain has also made moves towards previously. By the way, there's a lot of the Conservative Party, the Tories, have had a long interest in pulling out of the European Court of Human Rights, but the Kremlin is still obsessed with the idea that, Putin's romanticism from his time in Germany, that Russia is part of European civilization. And so, no, they won't do that, unfortunately. But there are a lot of – there's a growing political voice in Russia calling for us to get out of this insane court and its – absolutely insane judgments such as this, granting humanitarian salvation to a jihadi terrorist.
You know, I mean, this resounds in history all the way back to the beginning of the modern era of jihadi terrorism, to use that term. Back at the creation of the Mujahideen, the organizing of it by the Carter administration, Zbigniew Brzezinski famously being photographed and videoed with essentially Osama bin Laden's people, and creating this creature that's been, morphed now into ISIS and others.
Yeah, or you can look at the pictures out there readily on the internet of George W. Bush meeting with the Taliban in Texas, where they were called, the founding fathers of Afghanistan, akin to the founding fathers of the United States. We've seen this again and again. We saw it in the 80s in Afghanistan and Yemen with the support of jihadis. Most recently, we've seen it in Libya and Syria. It is a direct parallel to what is going on in Ukraine today, and which happened in the Cold War, in the beginning of the Cold War in the 1950s, when the West was openly supporting the Banderites, the Forrest Brothers in Western Ukraine as well. This isn't new, this support of moderate jihadis in the Middle East and moderate Nazis, as Dulles once phrased it, in Western Ukraine. This is the cynicism of it, is as long as the hatred and ire of these moderate Nazis and moderate jihadists is focused on Russia, then it's just fine. That's the cynical utility of it. And, that's the truth of it.
Russia's position that it keeps stating publicly, that the need to deal with this terrorism is something that's universal and certainly shared between both Western Europe and Russia, and especially the United States and Russia. And yet we see the same kind of thing playing out over and over again, as recently as yesterday at the State Department, and most likely today, too.
Yeah, and Russia has perhaps too consistently held by this position. If there is no consistency in the U.S. position, supporting terrorists here, against them here, torturing them there, giving them weapons in another place, Russia has been very consistent in its opposition to Sunni Salafist jihadism, which is, of course, the ideological cause behind most of what we consider Islamic terrorism. We've seen, for instance, in Israel. The Soviet Union, of course, during the Cold War, although it started off as one of the primary supporters of Israel in its original founding days, when Israel was socialist and forming kibbutzes and so on. Yeah. But, of course, later, as the Cold War developed, the Soviet Union and Israel were, of course, enemies, because Israel was, a primary ally of the United States. But since 1990, Russia and Israel have gone closer together. And, there's some opposition and, I think, legitimate criticism coming from the West, pointing out that Palestine has been occupied by Israel, for 60 plus years now. Yeah. And Russia still recognizes Palestinian independence, but they have moved away from any support of Hamas because of the ideology that this group has. And that's where Russia shows its consistency, even where perhaps it's to its detriment among, Arab widespread, public opinion. You have to agree. I mean, unfortunately, the Palestinians don't really have anyone that you can support, even when you do want to support them, because you can't support, the Salafists in Hamas, who even turned against Syria, which was one of their primary beneficiaries for years over the whole civil conflict there. And the Palestinian Authority are just quislings.
Yeah, right.
So. I mean, that's exactly what Israel wants, of course, that there's no one you can look there to support. But, you know, the truth is that while Russia, you know, politically maintains its mantra that, you know, of supporting Palestine, Palestinian state, Palestinian independence, it has grown closer and closer to Israel, and Hamas has been a big part of that. So consistency versus inconsistency in the opinion of terrorism, you know, specifically with this brand of Islamic terrorism.
Looking at the situation on the ground in Syria now, you know, there was this supposedly this discussion that took place on Monday between the U.S. and Russia over, you know, the matters before the Syria support group. This central conflict still exists, which is essentially that where Russia wants to take out all of the terrorists, and it classifies the terrorists as people who have taken up arms against the sovereign state from the outside. The United States is saying, well, you can attack these terrorists that are on this designated list and not those that aren't, even when the ones that aren't are, like yesterday, blowing up UN convoys.
Now, I wouldn't quite agree with that. Unfortunately, I would agree with that position. I think anyone who is foreign-backed, take up arms against the Syrian state, should be designated as a terrorist. Right. Russia does not do so. Russia's primary gauge of who is a terrorist, what they look at is secularism versus a jihadi ideology. Right. And Russia has long held conferences, meetings in Moscow to support so-called moderate opposition, primarily those who have not picked up arms, but also many of those who have, whom take greater lengths to separate themselves from the jihadis. And those are what Russia would consider moderate opposition. And it has gone out of its way not to target them when it can. Now, it has to be said that they are an extreme fringe minority of the forces actually fighting on the ground in Syria.
Right.
But they do exist in extremely small numbers, and Russia has used them often as tokens, if nothing else. But if these forces are fighting hand-in-hand with al-Qaeda, with Ahrar al-Sham, which is just an al-Qaeda splinter group, with the Army of Islam, right, as you pointed out before, right, you know, or with ISIS. I mean, the U.S.-backed Free Syrian Army was the last time they signed an alliance, a treaty with ISIS was just back in 2014. I mean, I'm old enough to remember 2014. I don't think the Western press is. But they signed a treaty and we're calling them brothers, you know, and fighting hand-in-hand on the battlefield with them. And that's something that won't penetrate the narrative, but it is a fact that you can Google yourself. I mean, you don't have to take my word for it. You know, that the Free Syrian Army was allied with ISIS just back in the end of 2014. You know, they were completely for them before they were against them. And, you know, and of course, the Free Syrian Army, you know, this amorphous U.S.-backed grab bag of brigades, they have never accepted the designation of Jabhat al-Nusra as a terrorist group, and they continue to fight alongside them. And whenever they fight alongside them, Russia has no qualms about targeting them. And this is where we get to with this whole recent venture by the United States. And what precipitated it is two events. One, as the cessation of hostilities broke down around Aleppo and Jabhat al-Nusra, and its allies, including the FSA and Ahrar al-Sham, went on the offensive against the Syrian army and started to take back village after village, Russia slowly started to make noise, then commenced to airstrikes piecemeal. And now we're at the point of heavy Russia bombardment, particularly north of Aleppo, and a Syrian Arab army offensive to counter this. And it looks like a serious effort this time. So that's one primary cause is, you know, the West's marbled proxies, you know, who won't, you know, separate and or can't be separated from their al-Qaeda allies around Aleppo. The other incident occurred near the Syrian-Jordanian border, where Russia targeted a base, illegally, of course, set up in Syria by U.S. proxies there, ostensibly to fight ISIS, of course. Russia bombed the airbase over U.S. objections, voiced some U.S. flew some airplanes in off the carrier in the Gulf. And Russia came back and bombed them again and then bombed them the next day. And the message they're sending is if you can't separate, you know, what the UN recognizes, the world recognizes, you yourself have recognized as terrorists, at least rhetorically, from your proxies, then how can you expect us to do it anywhere? Everyone is a target. And these two events leading together have led to Obama reaching out with this proposal. But this proposal is, of course, a poison pill, because it still says that the groups cannot be separated. But it attempts to create what the U.S. and Turkey have long argued for, these safe zones. And in fact, it intends to make all of Syria, except the skies above, all of Syria, a no-fly zone for Syrian's own air force. It proposes that Russia and the United States cooperate on airstrikes. But, of course, this would be all complicated by objections and deconfliction agreements. Meanwhile, the Syrian government is not allowed to use its own air force. It would effectively be grounded. And, of course, this hopefully should be unacceptable. Certainly it's unacceptable to the Syrian government, I would imagine. Right. However, Russia will be tempted by this because they have long pushed for military cooperation with the U.S. and Syria in order to justify their branding of this as solely an anti-terrorist operation. And, you know, again, Russia's plan all along has been to try to tie the U.S. into a peace process. And, you know, they have naively been roped along by the United States in this vein for a long time now. And, you know, most recently we saw it when, you know, Aleppo was all but surrounded and the jihadist forces were completely on the run. U.S. cried for a ceasefire back then and Russia accepted. And, you know, 3 months later, there's no separation between al-Qaeda and the U.S. proxies. Al-Qaeda now has a rejuvenated 20,000-strong force in the north of Aleppo, that whole Jarablus corridor area. They're rearmed with U.S. weapons. They were remilitarily organized in meetings in Turkey. Now we once again see forces coming out of Turkey in Latakia as well, recovering several towns for their caliphate in northern Latakia. So every time Russia agrees to a ceasefire, at the detriment of its allies, military progress always leads to setbacks. We've seen this repeatedly in Ukraine, in the Donbass. We've seen it in Syria. The Russia is too eager, in my mind, to seek out peace with the United States when the U.S. has never any intention of long-term abiding by this. It always points the finger as if the Syrian army was the one breaking these hostilities instead of the suicide bombing, head-chopping terrorists like al-Qaeda that their proxies are allied with. It's so cynical that at some point it just makes you want to be physically ill. And the U.S. is now dangling this out: ground the Syrian Air Force, and we'll work with you on this as long as we create the safe zones that, you know, for them to operate out of, that we've agreed to all along. And of course, this is dangerous for Russia because, once again, it would mean accepting that it is okay for the U.S., the West, Saudi Arabia to illegally arm, train, and salary people to overthrow the Syrian government. It would claim a type of legitimacy for them. Russia has already de facto granted it to them in some ways. Their only qualm is you separate yourself from the jihadists. And I find that a difficult position myself, but Russia is trying to avoid a direct, overt conflict with the United States and Saudi Arabia. So they're willing to go that distance.
And given, of course, the stakes in such a confrontation, it's not an insane policy to follow either.
It's naive, but it is sane. It is safe.
All right, Mark, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Don, thanks for having me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.